Chapter 12. A Bargain. A bath was not hard to find, though Elaine had to wait in the hall, frowning at the lion-carved doors of her apartments, drafts flickering the mirrored stand-lamps, while Rosoria and two of the guardswomen went in to search. Once they were sure there were no assassins lying in wait, and guards had been arrayed in the corridor and outer room, Elaine entered to find white-haired Asunda waiting in the bedchamber with Naris and Sephany, the two young tirewomen she was training. Asunda was slim, with Elaine's golden lily embroidered over her left breast, and a very great dignity emphasized by her deliberate way of moving, though some of that came from age and aching joints she refused to acknowledge. Naris and Sephany were sisters, fresh-faced, sturdy, and shy-eyed, proud of their livery and happy to have been chosen out for this rather than cleaning hallways, but almost as much in awe of Asunda as of Elaine. There were more experienced maids available, women who had worked years in the palace, but sadly girls who had come seeking any sort of work they could find were safer. Two copper bathtubs sat on thick layers of toweling laid atop the rose-colored floor tiles where one of the carpets had been rolled up, evidence that word of Elaine's arrival had flown ahead of her. Servants had a knack for learning what was happening that the tower's eyes and ears might envy. A good blaze in the fireplace and tight casements in the windows made the room warm after the corridors, and Asunda waited only to see Elaine enter the room before sending Sephany off at a run to fetch the men with the hot water. That would be brought up in double-walled pails with lids to keep it from getting cold on the way from the kitchens, though it might be delayed a little by guardswomen checking to make sure there were no knives hidden in the water. Avienda eyed the second bathtub almost as doubtfully as Asunda eyed Birgitta, the one still uneasy about actually stepping into water, and the other still not accepting that anyone more than necessary should be present during a bath. But the white-haired woman wasted no time before quietly bustling Elaine and Avienda both into the dressing room, where another fire on a wide marble hearth had taken the chill from the air. It was a great relief to have Asunda to help her out of her riding clothes, knowing that she had more ahead of her than a hasty wash and a show of ease, while worrying about how quickly she could move on to her next destination. Other pretenses awaited the light helper, and other worries, but she was home, and that counted for much. She could almost forget about that beacon shining in the west. Almost. Well, not at all, really, but she could manage to stop fretting over it as long as she did not dwell on the thing. By the time they had been undressed, with Avienda slapping Naris's hands away and removing her own jewelry, doing her best to pretend that Naris did not exist, and her garments were somehow removing themselves, by the time they had been bundled into embroidered silk robes and had their hair tied up in white toweling, Avienda tried to wrap the towel around her own head three times, and only after the construction collapsed down her neck for the third time did she allow Naris to do it, muttering about getting so soft that she soon would need someone to lace up her boots, until Elaine began laughing and she joined in, throwing her head back so that Naris had to start over again. By the time all that was done, and they had returned to the bedchamber, the bathtubs were full, and the scent of the rose oil that had been added to the water filled the air. The men who had brought up the water were gone, of course, and Sephany was waiting with her sleeves pushed above her elbows in case someone wanted her back scrubbed. Birgitta was sitting on the turquoise inlaid chest at the foot of the bed, her elbows on her knees. Elaine allowed Asunda to help her off with her pale green swallow-worked robe and sank into her tub immediately, submerging herself to her neck in water just a hair short of too hot. That left her knees poking up, but it immersed most of her in the warmth, and she sighed, feeling weariness leach out of her and languor creep in. Hot water might have been the greatest single gift of civilization. Staring at the other tub, Avienda gave a start when Naris attempted to remove her robe, lavender and embroidered with flowers on the wide sleeves. Grimacing, she finally allowed it and stepped gingerly into the water, But she snatched the round soap out of Stephanie's hand and began washing herself vigorously. Vigorously, but very careful not to slop so much as a spoonful of water over the tub's rim. The Aiel did use water for washing, as well as in the sweat tents, especially for rinsing out the shampoo they made from a fat leaf that grew in the waste. Yet the dirty water was conserved and used for watering crops. Elaine had shown her two of the great cisterns beneath Camelin, fed by a pair of underground rivers, and large enough that the far side of each was lost in a forest of thick columns and shadows. But the arid waste was in Avienda's bones. Ignoring Esunda's pointed looks, she seldom said two words more than necessary, and thought baths no time to say anything. Birgitta talked while they bathed, though she took care of what she said in front of Naris and Stephanie. It was unlikely they were in the pay of another house, but maids gossiped almost as freely as men. It seemed almost a tradition. Some rumors were worth fostering, nonetheless. Mostly, Birgitta talked of two huge merchants' trains that had arrived yesterday from Tyr, the wagons heavy with grain and salted beef, and another from Ilion with oil and salt and smoked fish. It was always worthwhile reminding people that food continued to flow into the city. Few merchants braved the roads of Andor in winter, none carrying anything as cheap as food. But gateways meant that Aramilla could intercept all the merchants she wished, and her forces still would starve long before Camelin felt the first pangs of hunger. The Windfinders, who were making most of those gateways, reported that the High Lord Darlin, claiming the title of Steward in Tyr for the Dragon Reborn of all things, was besieged in the Stone of Tyr by nobles who wanted the Dragon Reborn out of Tyr completely, but even they were unlikely to try stopping a rich trade in grain, particularly since they believed the kin who accompanied the Windfinders were Aes Sedai. Not that any real attempt was made at deception, but great serpent rings had been made for kinswomen who had passed their tests for accepted before being put out of the tower, and if anyone drew the wrong conclusion, no one actually lied to them. The water was going to shed its heat if she waited much longer, Elaine decided, so she took a rose-scented soap from Stephanie and allowed Naris to begin scrubbing her back with a long-handled brush. If there had been news of Gawain or Galad, Birgitta would have mentioned it straight off. She was as eager to hear as Elaine, and she could not have held it back. Gawain's return was one rumor that dearly wanted to reach the streets. Birgitta performed her duties well as Captain General, and Elaine meant her to keep the position if she could be convinced, but having Gawain there would allow both women to relax a little. Most of the soldiers in the city were mercenaries, and only enough of them to man the gates strongly and make a display along the miles of wall surrounding the new city, but they still numbered more than 30 companies, each with its own captain, who inevitably was full of pride, obsessed with precedence, and ready to squabble over any imagined slight from another captain at the drop of a straw. Gawain had trained his whole life to command armies. He could deal with the squabblers, leaving her free to secure the throne. Apart from that, she simply wanted him away from the White Tower. She prayed that one of her messengers had gotten through and that he was well downriver by this time. Egwene had been besieging Tar Valon with her army for more than a week now, and it would be the cruelest spinning of fate for Gawain to be caught between his oaths to defend the tower and his love for Egwene. Worse, he had already broken that oath once, or at least bent it, for love of his sister, and perhaps his love of Egwene. If Elida ever suspected that Gawain had aided Suan's escape, whatever credit he had gained by helping her replace Suan as Amarlin would evaporate like a dewdrop, and if he was still within Elida's reach when she learned, he would find himself in a cell, and lucky to avoid the headsman. Elaine did not resent his decision to aid Elida. He could not have known enough then to make any other choice. A good many sisters had been confused over what was happening, too. A good many still seemed to be. How could she ask Gawain to see what Aes Sedai could not? As for Galad, she had grown up unable to like the man. Sure, he must resent her, and resent Gawain most of all. Galad had to have thought he would be first prince of the sword one day, until Gawain was born. Her earliest memories of him were of a boy, a young man, already behaving more like a father or uncle than a brother, giving Gawain his first lessons with a sword. She remembered being afraid he would break open Gawain's head with the practice blade. But he had never given more than the bruises any youth expected in learning swords. He knew what was right, Galad did, and he was willing to do what was right no matter the cost to anyone, including himself. Light, he had started a war to help her and Nynaeve escape from Samara, and it was likely he had known the risk from the start. Galad fancied Nynaeve, or had for a time. It was hard to imagine he still felt that way, with him a white cloak, but Light only knew where and doing what. But the truth was he had started that war to rescue his sister. She could not condone him being a child of the Light. She could not like him. Yet she hoped that he was safe and well. She hoped he found his way home to Camelin, too. News of him would have been nearly as welcome as news of Gawain. That surprised her, but it was true. Two more sisters came while you were away. They're at the Silver Swan. Birgitta made it sound as though they were merely stopping at an inn, because every bed in the palace was taken. A green with two warders and a grey with one. They came separately. A yellow and a brown left the same day, so there are still 10 altogether. The yellow went south toward Farmadding. The brown was heading east. Stephanie, waiting patiently beside Avienda's tub with nothing to do, exchanged a glance with her sister over Elaine's head and grinned. Like many in the city, they knew for a fact that the presence of Aes Sedai at the Silver Swan signified White Tower support for Elaine and House Trakand. Watching the two girls like a hawk, Essenda nodded. She knew it, too. Every street sweeper and rag picker was aware that the tower was divided against itself. But even so, the name still carried weight, and an image of strength that never failed. Everyone knew the White Tower had lent support to every rightful queen of Andor. In truth, most sisters looked forward to a sitting monarch who was also Aes Sedai, the first in 1,000 years and the first since the breaking of the world to be openly known as Aes Sedai. But Elaine would not be surprised to find there was a sister in Aramilla's camp, keeping discreetly out of notice. The White Tower never placed all of its coin on one horse unless the race was fixed. "That's enough of the brush," she said, irritably twisting away from the bristles. Well-trained, the girl laid the brush down on a stool and handed her a large Ilianer sponge that she used to begin sluicing off soap. She wished she knew what those sisters meant. They were like a grain of sand in her slipper, so tiny a thing that you could hardly imagine it being a discomfort, but the longer it remained, the larger it seemed. The sisters at the Silver Swan were becoming a sizable stone just by being there. Since before she arrived in Camelin, the number at the inn had been changed frequently, a few sisters leaving every week and a few coming to replace them. The siege had not changed anything. The soldiers surrounding Camelin were no more likely to try stopping an Aes Sedai from going where she wanted than were the rebellious nobles in Tyr. There had been Reds in the city, too, for a while, asking after men heading for the Black Tower. But the more they learned, the more they had let their disgruntlement show, and the last pair had ridden out of the city the day after Aramilla appeared before the walls. Every Aes Sedai who entered the city was carefully watched, and none of the Reds had gone near the Silver Swan, so it seemed unlikely the sisters there had been sent by Elaida to kidnap her. For some reason she imagined little groups of Aes Sedai scattered from the Blight to the Sea of Storms, and constant streams of sisters flowing between, gathering information, sharing information. A peculiar thought. Sisters used eyes and ears to watch the world and rarely shared what they learned unless it was a threat to the tower itself. Likely those at the Swan were among the sisters sitting out the tower's troubles, waiting to see whether Egwene or Elaida would end with the Ummerlin seat before they declared themselves. That was wrong. An Aes Sedai should stand for what she thought was right without worrying over whether she was choosing the winning side. But these made her uneasy for another reason. Recently, one of her watchers at the Swan had overheard a disturbing name, murmured and quickly shushed, as if in fear of eavesdroppers. Cadswain. Not a common name, that. And Cadswain Maladrin had meshed herself closely with Rand while he was in Kyrian. Van Deen did not think much of the woman, calling her opinionated and mule-headed, but Kariana had almost fainted in awe at hearing her name. It seemed the stories surrounding Cadswain amounted to legends. Trying to deal with the Dragon Reborn single-handed was just the sort of thing Cadswain Maladrin might do. Not that Elaine had concerns about Rand and Eni Aes Sedai, except that he might outrage her beyond her control. The man was too pig-headed himself sometimes to see where his own good lay. But why would a sister in Camelin mention her name? And why had another hushed her? Despite the hot bath water, she shivered, thinking of all the webs the White Tower had spun through the centuries, so fine that none could see them except the sisters who did the spinning, so convoluted that none but those sisters could have unraveled them. The tower spun webs, the Ajahs spun webs, even individual sisters spun webs. Sometimes those schemes blended into one another as though guided by a single hand. Other times they had pulled one another apart. That was how the world had been shaped for 3,000 years. Now the tower had divided itself neatly into rough thirds. One third for Egwene, one for Elida, and one that was standing aside. If those last were in contact with one another, exchanging information, forming plans, the implications... A sudden tumult of voices dimmed by the closed door made her sit up straight. Naris and Sephany squealed and leaped to clutch one another, staring wide-eyed at the door. "What in the bloody flaming—" Snarling, Birgitta hurled herself off the chest and out of the room, slamming the door behind her. The voices rose higher. It did not sound as if the guardswomen were fighting, just arguing at the tops of their lungs, and the bond carried mainly anger and frustration, along with her bloody headache. But Elaine climbed out of the bathtub, holding out her arms for Isunda to slip her robe on. The white-haired woman's calmness, and perhaps Elaine's, soothed the two maids enough that they blushed when Isunda looked at them. But Avienda leaped from her tub, splashing water everywhere, and dashed dripping into the dressing room. Elaine expected her to return with her belt knife, but instead she came back surrounded by the glow of Sidar and holding the amber turtle in one hand. With the other she handed Elaine the Ungreal that had been in her belt pouch, an aged ivory carving of a woman clothed only in her hair. Accepting the towel atop her head, Avienda wore only a wet sheen, and she angrily waved Stephanie away when the woman tried to put her robe on her. Knife or no knife, Avienda still tended to think as if she were going to fight with a blade, and might need to move suddenly. "Put this back in the dressing room," Elaine said, handing the ivory Ungreal to Isunda. "Avienda, I really don't think we need to—" The door opened a crack, and Birgitta put her head in, scowling. Naris and Sephany jumped, not so soothed as they had seemed. "Zyda wants to see you," Birgitta growled at Elaine. "I told her she'd have to wait, but—" With a sudden yelp, she staggered into the room, catching her balance after two steps, and whirling to face the woman who had pushed her. The wave mistress of Clan Catalar did not look as though she had pushed anyone. The ends of her intricately knotted red sash swirling about her knees, she entered the room calmly, followed by two windfinders, one of whom shut the door in Rasoria's angry face. All three swayed when they moved nearly as much as Birgitta did in her heeled boots. Zyda was short, with streaks of grey in her tightly curled hair, but her dark face was one of those that grew more beautiful with the years, and her beauty only seemed magnified by the golden chain, heavy with small medallions, that connected one of her fat golden earrings to her nose ring. More importantly, her air was one of command, not of arrogance, but of the knowledge that she would be obeyed. The windfinders eyed Avienda, still glowing with the power, and Shanella's angular face tightened. Yet aside from a murmur from Shyalin that the Aiel girl was ready to weave, they remained silent and waited. The 8 earrings in Shyalin's ears marked her as windfinder to a clan wave mistress, and Shanella's honor chain carried nearly as many golden medallions as that of Zyda herself. Both were women of authority, and it was plain in the way they held themselves and moved, yet one needed to know nothing of the Atha an Mir to know, as soon as one saw them, that Zaida din Parida held the first spot. "Your boots must have tripped you, Captain General," she murmured with a small smile on her full lips, one dark-tattooed hand toying with the golden scent box that dangled on her chest. "Clumsy things, boots." She and the two windfinders were barefoot, as always. The soles of the Atha an Mir's feet were as tough as shoe soles, unbothered by rough decks or cold floor tiles. Strangely, in addition to their blouses and trousers of brightly colored silk brocades, each woman wore a wide stole of plain white that hung below her waist and almost hid her multitude of necklaces. "I was taking a bath," Elaine said in a tight voice, as if they could not see that, with her hair done up and her robe clinging to her damply. Esanda was almost quivering with indignation, which meant she must be beside herself with fury. Elaine felt close to it herself. "I will be taking a bath again as soon as you go. I will speak with you when I have finished taking my bath, if it pleases the light. There. If they were going to shove into her rooms, let them chew on that for ceremony." "The grace of the light be upon you also, Elaine Sedai," Zaida replied smoothly. She raised an eyebrow at Avienda, though neither at the continuing light of Sidar, since Zaida could not channel, nor at her nudity, since the sea folk were quite casual about that, at least out of sight of landmen. "You have never invited me to bathe with you, though it would have been courteous, but we will not speak of that. I have learned that Nesta Din Rias Two Moons is dead, killed by the Shonchan. We mourn her loss." All three women touched their white stoles and touched fingertips to lips, yet Zaida seemed as impatient with formality as Elaine. Without raising her voice or speeding its pace, she merely pushed on, almost shockingly abrupt and to the point for one of the sea folk. "The first 12 of the Atha an Mir must meet to choose another mistress of the ships. What is happening to the west makes it clear there can be no delay." Shailen's mouth tightened, and Shanella raised her pierced scent box to her nose, as if to drown the smell of something. Its spicy perfume was sharp enough to slice through the scent of rose oil in the room. However they had described what they sensed to Zaida, she displayed no unease, or anything but certainty. Her gaze held steady on Elaine's face. "We must be ready for whatever comes, and for that we need a mistress of the ships. In the name of the White Tower, you promised 20 teachers. I cannot take Van Deen in her grief or you, but I will take the other 3 with me. The rest the White Tower owes, and I will expect prompt payment. I have sent to the sisters at the Silver Swan to see whether some of them will meet the Tower's debt, but I cannot wait on their reply. If it pleases the light, I will bathe with the other wave mistresses tonight at the harbor of Ilion." Elaine fought very hard to keep her own face smooth. The woman just announced that she intended to scoop up every Aes Sedai lying around loose in Camelin and carry them off. And it sounded very much as if she did not intend to leave any of the wavefinders behind. That made Elaine's heart sink. Until Rihanna returned, there were 7 of the kin with sufficient strength to weave a gateway, but 2 of those could not make one large enough to admit a horse cart. Without the Windfinders, plans for keeping Camelin supplied from Tyr and Ilion became problematical at best. The Silver Swan. Light, whoever Zaida had sent would reveal every line of the bargain she had made. Egwene was not going to thank her for spilling that mess out into the open. She did not think she had ever had so many problems dropped in her lap in the course of one short statement. "I regret your loss and the Atha an Mir's loss," she said, thinking fast. "Nesta Din Rias was a great woman. She had been a powerful woman anyway, and a very strong personality." Elaine had felt happy to walk away with more than her shift after her one meeting with her. Speaking of shifts, she could not afford time to dress. Zaida might not wait. She belted her robe tighter. "We must talk. Have wine brought for our guests, Esanda, and tea for me." "Weak tea," she sighed at a burst of caution through the bond to Birgitta. "In the smaller sitting room. Will you join me, wave mistress?" To her surprise, Zaida merely nodded as if she had expected this. That started Elaine thinking about Zaida's side of the bargain between them. The bargains. There were two, really. And that might be a key point. No one had expected the smaller sitting room to be used for some time, so the air held a chill, even after Stephanie rushed with a spark wheel to light the kindling laid beneath split oak on the wide white hearth and scurried out of the room. Flames leapt up from the fat wood, catching on the log atop the fire irons as the women arrayed themselves in the lightly carved, low-backed chairs arranged in a semicircle in front of the fireplace. Well, Elaine and the sea folk women arrayed themselves, Elaine arranging her robe carefully over her knees and wishing Zaida had delayed just an hour so she could be properly dressed, the windfinders coolly waiting for the wave mistress to take a chair, then sitting to either side of her. Birgitta stood in front of the writing table with her hands on her hips and her feet apart, her face a thunderhead. The bond carried a clear desire to wring an Atha an Mier neck. Avienda leaned casually against one of the sideboards, and even when Asanda brought her robe and pointedly held it out for her, she merely put it on and resumed her pose with her arms folded beneath her breasts. She had released Sidar, but the turtle was still in her hand, and Elaine suspected she was ready to embrace the power again in an instant. Neither Avienda's cold, green-eyed stare nor Birgitta's scowl affected the sea folk in the least, however. They were who they were, and they knew who they were. The Atha an Mier were promised 20 teachers, Elaine said, emphasizing slightly. Zaida had said that she had been promised, that she would collect payment, but that bargain had been made with Nesta Din Rias. Of course, Zaida might believe she would become the new mistress of the ships herself. Proper teachers to be selected by the Amerlin seat. I know that the Atha an Mier pride themselves on meeting their bargains in full, and the tower will meet its side too. But you knew when sisters here agreed to teach that it was temporary, and a bargain quite apart from that made with the mistress of the ships. You admitted as much when you agreed for windfinders to weave gateways to bring supplies to Camelin from Ilion and Tyr. Surely you would not have gotten involved in the affairs of the Shorebound for any reason other than paying off a bargain. But if you are leaving, your help is at an end, and so is our requirement to teach. I fear you will harvest no teachers at the Silver Swan, either. The Atha an Mier will have to wait until the Amerlin sends teachers, according to the bargain made with the mistress of the ships. A pity she could not demand they stay away from the inn, but it might already be too late for that, and every reason she could think of sounded hollow. An argument that shattered for lack of a center would only embolden Zaida. The Atha an Mier were ferocious hagglers, scrupulous but ferocious. She had to go very slowly, very carefully. "My sister has you by the ear, Zaida Din Parida," Avienda chortled, slapping her thigh. "Hung up by the ankles, in fact." That was a sea folk punishment that she found incredibly amusing for some reason. Elaine stifled a burst of irritation. Avienda enjoyed chances to tweak the sea folk's noses. She had begun while they were fleeing Ebu Dar and never really stopped, but this was no time for it. Shanella stiffened, her calm face sinking into a glare. The lean woman had been the butt of Avienda's nose-tweaking more than once, including a regrettable episode involving usquai, a very potent Aiel drink. The glow of Sidar actually surrounded her. Zaida could not see that, but she knew about the usquai and Shanella being carried to her bed, sicking up the whole way, and she raised a peremptory hand toward the windfinder. The glow faded, and Shanella's face darkened. It might have been a blush or anger. "All that you say may be so," Zaida said, which was not far from insulting, especially said to an Aes Sedai. In any event, Merilila was not part of that. She agreed to be one of the teachers long before she reached Camelin, and she will go with me to continue her teaching. Elaine drew a long breath. She could not even try to argue Zaida out of this. A great part of the White Tower's influence rested on the fact that the Tower kept its word as surely as the sea folk, that it was known to keep its word. Oh, people said you had to listen carefully to be sure an Aes Sedai had promised what you thought she had, and that was often true. But once the promise was clear, it was as good as an oath under the light. At least the Windfinders were not likely to let Marilla get away. They hardly let her out of their sight. You may have to return her to me if I have particular need of her. If Van Deen and the two helpers found proof that she was Black Aja. If that happens, I will arrange a replacement. And who that could be, she had no idea. She has the rest of her year to serve. At least a year, by the bargain. Zaida gestured as if making a concession. But so long as you understand that her replacement must come before she leaves, I will not let her go without another in her place. I suppose that will do, Elaine replied calmly. It would bloody well have to, since she had no other choice. Zaida smiled faintly and let the silence stretch. Shanella shifted her feet, but more in impatience than as if to rise, and the wave mistress did not stir. Plainly she wanted something more, intended another bargain, and plainly she wanted Elaine to speak first. Elaine set herself to outwait the other woman. The fire had begun to blaze and crackle, sending sparks up the chimney and radiating a fine warmth into the room, but her damp robe absorbed the chill in the air and transferred it to her skin. Ignoring the cold was all very well, but how were you supposed to ignore being cold and wet? She met Zaida's gaze levelly and matched her tiny smile. Esunda returned, followed by Naris and Stephanie, carrying ropework trays, the one with a silver teapot in the shape of a lion and thin green cups of seafolk porcelain, the other hammered silver cups and a tall-necked wine pitcher that gave off the aroma of spices. Everyone took wine, except for Elaine, who was never offered the choice. Peering into her tea, she sighed. She could see the bottom of the cup quite clearly. If they made it any weaker, they might as well give her water. After a moment, Avienda strode across the room to set her wine cup back on the tray atop one of the sideboards and pour herself a cup of tea. She gave Elaine a nod and a smile, combining sympathy with the suggestion that she really preferred watery tea to wine. Elaine smiled back in spite of herself. First sisters shared the bad as well as the good. Birgitta grinned over the top of her silver cup and proceeded to empty half of it in a gulp. The bond carried her amusement at the grumpiness she felt from Elaine, and it still carried her headache, in no way reduced. Elaine rubbed her temple. She should have insisted that Marilla heal the woman as soon as she had seen her. A number of the kin outstripped Marilla when it came to healing, but she was the only sister in the palace with a halfway decent ability.
"You have great need of women to make these gateways," Zaida said suddenly.
Her full mouth was no longer smiling. She disliked having spoken first. Elaine sipped her wretched excuse for tea and said nothing.
"It might please the light that I could leave one or two windfinders here," Zaida went on, "for a set time."
Elaine wrinkled her brow as though considering. She needed those bloody women and more than one or two. "What would you ask in return?" she said finally.
1 square mile of land on the River Aranin. Good land, mind, not marshy or boggy. It is to be Ataan Mier land in perpetuity. Under our laws, not Andor's," she added, as if that were a small afterthought, hardly worth mentioning.
Elaine choked on her tea. The Ataan Mier hated leaving the sea, hated being out of sight of it, and Zaida was asking for land 1,000 miles from the nearest salt water, asking for it to be ceded absolutely at that. Kyrianin and Murandians and even Altarans had bled trying to take bits of Andor, and Andorans had bled to keep them out. Still, 1 square mile was a small bit, and a small price to keep Camelin supplied. Not that she would let Zaida know that. And if the sea folk began trading directly into Andor, then Andoran goods would be able to move in sea folk bottoms everywhere the sea folk sailed, and that was everywhere. Zaida surely knew that already, but there was no point in letting her know that Elaine had thought of it. The warder bond urged caution, yet there were times for boldness, as Birgitta should know better than anyone. Sometimes tea goes down the wrong way.
Not a lie, merely an evasion.
For a square mile of Andor, I deserve more than 2 windfinders. The other Unmier got 20 teachers and more for help using the Bowl of the Winds, and when they go, you will have 20 to replace them. You have 21 windfinders with you. For a mile of Andor, I should have all 21, and 21 more in their places when they leave, for as long as Aes Sedai teach sea folk. Best not to let the woman think that was her way of rejecting the offer out of hand. Of course, the normal customs duties would apply to any goods moving off this land into Andor. Zaida raised her silver cup to her mouth, and when she lowered it, she wore the tiniest smile. Yet Elaine thought it was a smile of relief rather than triumph.
Goods moving into Andor, but not goods coming from the river onto our land. I might leave 3 windfinders. For half a year, say. And they must not be used in fighting. I will not have my people die for you, and I will not have other Andorans angry at us because sea folk have killed some of them.
They will be asked only to make gateways, Elaine said, though they must make them wherever I require.
Light, as if she intended using the One Power as a weapon.
The sea folk did so without a second thought, but she was trying very hard to behave as Egwene demanded, as though she had already taken the 3 oaths. Besides, if she blasted those camps outside the walls with Sidar, or allowed anyone else to, not a house in Andor would stand with her. They must stay until my crown is secure, whether that is half a year or longer. The crown should be hers in much less time, but as her old nurse Linny used to say, you counted your plums in the basket, not on the tree. Once the crown was hers, though, she would not need windfinders to supply the city, and in all truth, she would be happy to see their backs. But 3 is not nearly enough. You will want Shyalin, since she is your windfinder. I will keep the rest. The medallions on Zaida's honor chain swayed gently as she shook her head. Talaan and Matara are apprentices still. They must return to their training. The others have duties, too. 4 might be spared until your crown is secure. From there, it was just a matter of bargaining. Elaine had never expected to keep the apprentices, and windfinders to clan wave mistresses could not be spared either, which she had expected. Most wave mistresses used their windfinders and swordmasters as close advisers, and would be parted from one as easily as she would be parted from Birgitta. Zaida tried to exclude others as well, such as windfinders who served on large vessels like rakers and skimmers. But that would have disqualified the greater number right there, and Elaine refused, and refused to come down in her demands unless Zaida came up in her offers. Which the woman did slowly, grudging every concession. But not so slowly as Elaine might have expected. Clearly the wave mistress needed this bargain as much as she herself needed women who could weave gateways. Under the light, it is agreed, she was able to say at last, kissing the fingertips of her right hand and leaning forward to press them to Zaida's lips. Avienda grinned, obviously impressed. Birgitta kept a smooth face, but the bond said she found it hard to believe Elaine had come out so well.
It is agreed under the light, Zaida murmured.
Her fingers on Elaine's lips were hard and calloused, though she could not have hauled on a rope herself in many years. She looked quite satisfied for a woman who had yielded 9 of the 14 windfinders who had been on the table. Elaine wondered how many of those 9 would be women whose ships had been destroyed by the Shonchan in Ebu Dar. Losing a ship was a serious matter among the Atha Anmier, whatever the reason, and maybe cause enough to want to stay away from home a little longer. No matter. Shanella looked glum, her tattooed hands tight on the knees of her red brocaded trousers, yet not so glum as might be expected from a sea folk woman who would have to remain ashore a while longer. She was to command the windfinders who stayed, and she did not like it that Zaida had acceded to her being under Elaine's authority and Birgitta's. There were to be no more sea folk striding around the palace as if they owned it and making demands left and right. But then Elaine suspected that Zaida had come to this meeting knowing she would leave some of her party behind, and Shanella had come knowing she would command them. That hardly mattered either, nor did it matter what advantage Zaida hoped to gain toward becoming mistress of the ships. That she saw some was clear as good glass. All that mattered was that Camlin would not go hungry. That and the bloody beacon still blazing in the west. No, she would be a queen, and she could not be a moonstruck girl. Camlin and Andor were all that could matter.